you want to say anything
about it. Say good morning to Mrs. Nathan, correctly this time. You. I don't know why. I said Blakeville before.
Well, I'm going to go down in history.
Yes.
The way of... It's much better to have it... have the volume high and then let her turn it down. You see, she can do that.
Yes.
Otherwise, you know, soft remarks don't always come. Well, you had just said a word about your son. Maybe we should just go on with him a little bit. Did he grow up in Berkeley?
No, that jumps up to my Harvard days.
Oh, well, maybe we better stay in sequence.
All right, yes.
Or whatever.
Yes.
Whatever suits you. I don't think I asked you about, did you have any grandparents that you recall, or is that sort of...
But just this
just
old
the one grandmother.
Grandmother. The other grandparents had died long before I was around.
Let's see, we had gotten you past grammar school and, let's see, high school then would be...
Berkeley High School.
Berkeley High.
Mm-hmm. And I think I entered Berkeley High School in the autumn of 1905. Just to be there in time for April 18th, which was a big earthquake.
Oh, yes.
And that earthquake, fortunately, happened, you know, about 5:15 in the morning. But it knocked the big chimneys of the old brick building, the old high school, down. And those chimneys came right down on the stairways of the high school. There have been hundreds of children killed if that earthquake had happened in the daytime.
Oh, yes.
And, great holes in the roof, I remember, when we went down in the morning, here was the school, standing, of course, but these huge chimneys just came down on the stairways. And the school was so badly damaged that for the rest of the term, they held the high school in various churches around town, things of that sort. And Mrs. Hirst was in Paris, and I remember Mother hiring a car and driving down to Pleasanton to see what had happened down there. And the old house wasn't hurt very much. Some fireplaces fell out, one or two of the flower pots were knocked over, but fortunately they went out and didn't come through the roof. So the house wasn't damaged very much. But here in Berkeley, the two of our chimneys were knocked off. And the earthquake was really a much more violent thing than I've ever experienced in any other earthquakes in my life, even in Peru.
Yeah, right.
It was and then we watched San Francisco burn for 3 days with this terrific cloud of smoke. And it must have been about 9 or 10 in the morning, we first saw this tremendous column of smoke going up above San Francisco. It looked like the pictures in the old geography books the eruption of Mount Vesuvius, tremendous cloud.
Last days of Pompeii.
Yes, a great cloud of billowing smoke, like a cumulus cloud going up from the city.
Was it a black smoke?
No, it was whitish. You see, as the heat went up, it condensed, so it really made a great cloud, like a cumulus cloud, over the city.
Oh, I see.
The water in the air would condense in the rising heat. So the top of it was really like a great white cloud going up. In the first day, afterwards, it spread out a great deal, and it was just a mass of smoke, except at night you could see the terrific reflection. The first night, the fire was all from here, was all behind the island. Near Buena Island. So the island was silhouetted against these great flames shooting up above it. And the next night, the fire, as you saw it from Berkeley, was on both sides of the island. I think that then the Fairmont and all that country up in there burned. And then there was still a third night of fire. And very few of a series of earthquakes afterwards. There was shakes. I remember that morning, we could just see the houses rocking. And very few of our friends turned up. They were driven out, you see, by the fires, the other part of San Francisco. And it wasn't until there was communication, they got down to the ferries, that many came over to Berkeley. Except a good many from south of Market in that area escaped to Berkeley, and there were tents put up on the campus for the refugees and things of that sort. But, so rather a dramatic time.
Oh, immensely so.
I should have been more adventurous and gone over to San Francisco, but it seemed better to stay at home.
Yes. No, I can't quite see the...
Unfortunately, there was no fire here.
Yes. Well, you were speaking of the effects on the Berkeley High School building. Was that located where Berkeley High is?
It's on the same corner mm-hmm. as the present school. That building was repaired and lasted. I continued in school there after. Well, to go on with the story,
yeah.
Mrs. Hurst then cabled us to come over to France to join her, so we went over to cut that year. I didn't finish that high school year. And we went to join Mrs. Hurst in Paris.
Oh, how exciting!
And had a lovely time. She had a very beautiful apartment on the Place de l'Alma.
Oh, yes.
Which is, you know, right on the river.
And there's a bridge.
There's the Pont de l'Alma right there. And so we were living there. I was fascinated with an old hydraulic elevator in the building. It had a long shaft that ran up and down. I was the only boy in the household, and I just couldn't be dragged around with the ladies. Of course, I regarded my mother as an old lady too,
oh, yeah.
Shopping and so on. So I went off on my own and really explored Paris very thoroughly, riding up and down the river on the boats. And I remember accidentally getting down to the island and seeing Notre Dame for the first time, and not particularly knowing where I was or what it was, but being very excited having made this discovery. I explored Notre Dame from tops of the towers to the crypts. Then later I remember Mrs. Hayes officially taking me around to show me the sights, and I'd seen practically everything before. They took me around a great deal more than they had ever seen.
Yes, I'm sure you did.
So I really acquired a geographical sense of Paris that's always stayed with me.
Mm-hmm.
Like I feel I know just where I am today in Paris.
Did you have any French at your command at this time?
Well, not very much. I didn't really have. I'd taken one high school course in French, and my French was terrible, but enough to ask questions and to get around. And my ability as a linguist is very poor anyway, but I managed to get around. So I found getting back in Paris, the latter part of the war, was my geography of Paris helped a good deal, though. I
yes,
had a lot,
you know,
to a lot of new things to learn at that age, at a later age.
Well, I think to have you personally discover the island and the
yes.
and Notre Dame.
Yes. Then we went down to Italy on that trip, and one pleasant thing, we spent, I think, the month of February with the, what month was that? No, it was when did we go over? We went over in October.
Oh.
No, I'm getting a little confused there in my timing. No, we didn't go over right after the earthquake. Well, I finished that term here in Berkeley. And we didn't go over to the fault till the following year. It was 19. Mrs. Hay still stayed over there, didn't come back. And we went over in October in the in 1906.
Mm-hmm.
And then went down and spent part of the winter in Italy. And I remember we spent a month in a villa on the island of Capri with the Richard Walton Tully's. Tully was a playwright who wrote The Girl of the Golden West and a couple of other plays. I've forgotten their names. And she was Eleanor Gates, who wrote a novel, one novel that was a successful novel, but not a bestseller. Anyway, they were young people, relatively young, both of Berkeley graduates. But it was started off in a very great way, and then apparently never went over an early peak. Didn't do much afterwards. I'm sure they, I don't know just when they died. He was, I think he was Yale leader here on the campus.
Oh, really? What part of Italy was this?
That's Naples, you know.
Was it Naples?
The island is this famous resort island.
Oh,
now.
Yes.
Capri, C-A-P-R-I.
Yes, I wasn't sure that was where you stayed.
Yes, we had Elihu Vedder's villa. Elihu Vedder was an artist of great fame then, though not so much fame now, but did a lot of things in the general style of the 90s, I should say. Mm-hmm. It was an interesting house. It was called the Torre Quattro Venti, and we spent about a month there, and I, again, being off by myself, just explored Capri from one end to the other, made friends with boatmen, poked into all the little grottos and things of that sort. The island is perfectly fascinating. And that was before it was the resort itself. I haven't been back since.
The tales
you hear of Capri today are very different.
Quite different from that. How did Mrs. Hurst know Mr. Tully and Eleanor?
Oh, he was I think she knew him when he was a young playwright, shortly after he graduated. And she was always interested in young people. Here was a young fellow to help, and she helped his wife, and got them started.
Was it during this period that she found the well coping, or was that?
No, that was earlier. That must have gone back to the 90s. I don't know when she bought that, but it went to the old hacienda at the very beginning.
Oh, I see.
And I should have my dates better, but I think that was in the late 90s, 97, 98, something like that. So she was collecting even then. And that's where her son got his interest in old things, probably. Of course, he was a much, much greater collector than she was. Her collections were interesting, but he really went at it professionally.
Did you get to know him at all?
Oh yes, I knew him very well.
Did you?
And he was a very good friend. Mm-hmm. So I really never had anything officially to do with him, because I had never had any connection with the newspapers or the magazines. And we're getting ahead of the story, but he, after her death, and he inherited practically the whole estate, they sold all their stock in the mining companies, with the exception of one mine in Mexico, the San Luis Mining Company, which the Hearst estate still owns, has a dominant interest. But they sold out homestead completely. Shortly after Mrs. Hurst's death in 1919. And it's rather a strange thing that I end up running this host mine, which was the greatest thing the family had in those days, and a period of my entire association with it, the Hurst have had nothing whatever to do with it.
Yes, you know, I was wondering just how this...
One of those strange...
cooperative. I wonder why they divested themselves of the mining.
Well, he was very much involved in newspapers then.
Yeah.
And he really wasn't particularly interested in the mining. And he wanted all his financial strength concentrated in the newspaper, the publishing world. Of course, he made a tremendous record there.
Right. Well, I was interested in what you said about his collecting at a professional level, did he hire experts to advise
him? Oh, yes, he did. He had a great staff of people, as far as I know, mm-hmm. who were buying for him. And at the time of his death, well, it was before his death, I think it was the time the estate was, or his affairs were in pretty bad shape, they had warehouses filled with magnificent collections, and those collections were sold off. It's a great shame because it probably would have been the nucleus of one of the great museums in the country. All the works of art that he'd collected had been kept together. But San Simeon still has a lot of it, but there were a tremendous number of things sold.
Did he have any special interests, things that he liked in particular? It's so almost diffuse at San Simeon, it's hard to tell.
Yes, it's awfully hard. Nobody, I don't think, ever knew Mr. Hirsch completely. He was a very complicated person in many sides, many aspects. But my impression of his taste is that he was more interested in architectural details, carvings of stone, furniture, and ceilings, and things of that sort than he was in paintings. I don't think he ever had what would be the nucleus of a great art collection of paintings. He had many fine tapestries.
Yes.
He had a tremendous sense of medievalism, I think.
Yes, well, that's very interesting.
And San Simeon reflects that.
Right.
For the parts of the rooms that are the best are the ones that were really I think the medieval period running into the Renaissance. Mm-hmm. But mostly it was for great tapestries and the things like choir stalls.
Yes.
And the fine beds and the furniture.
Mm-hmm.
It's really marvelous that way.
Right. Well, that's a very good way to characterize
and
it.
The cluttering probably comes in from the contemporary things that were sort of put in for comfortable use,
mm-hmm.
which were nice to use, but did give it a somewhat cluttered feeling, as you commented on.
Yes, well, because grandeur is a little difficult to live with.
And yet it was a surprising, I always enjoyed it down there when I was visiting. I think I've slept in the Richelieu bed a couple of times and without any ill effects.
Oh, I'm very, maybe made you more subtle. Well, I did want to ask you about, excuse me, the way you would characterize Mrs. Hirsch. Of the few biographies that there are so saccharine.
Yes. They're not good.
The Annie Laurie.
Oh, that's a horrible book.
I
have a copy of it up here. She didn't know Mrs. Hirsch very well. I really don't ever remember seeing her down in Pleasanton, though I suppose she was there. I didn't pay too much attention to the people who were there.
No.
Well, except those that I was very much impressed with.
And I do want to ask you about them, too, but it's not possible that a woman who accomplished as much as Mrs. Hirsch did could have been this little spun sugar character.
Oh, she wasn't. She was a very dynamic, forthright little person with very positive ideas. And the life down there was a strange, strangely formal, stiff life in lots of ways. Never bothered me. I was doing just exactly what I wanted to do at that age, which seems strange now, riding horseback and swimming and enjoying the luxury and the good things and not minding it in the least.
Well, when you say that it was formal, do you mean that the table service was formal?
Oh, yes. We always dressed for dinner, even when there was only perhaps six at the table. And everything was formal in the Victorian way. It was the dinners and so on were entertaining because there were so many interesting people down there. Moss Stevens was a very frequent guest. I knew him very well in that connection. And other people from the Berkeley faculty were down there. Benjamin Knight Wheelers were there a great deal. And it was a lively, interesting dinner conversation. But you dressed for dinner, and I think probably one cocktail was served. Not only when it was a largest party, and then there'd be at least three of the very best wines served. But I don't think anybody would ever be invited whoever had one too many.
No. Well, she had her own
yes.
views, I'm sure. Did you have a footman behind each chair?
Oh, no. It wasn't as formal as that. But there were, I imagine there were practically always two butlers.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't country living.
It wasn't country living at all. But it was rather a strange combination because it was country horseback riding and hiking in the hills. And I remember with embarrassment one time at rather a formal luncheon in their big dining room. There were nearly always 20 people or 25 over the weekends. I felt something on my neck and reached up and gave a little flip and a wood tick popped out. Landed on a very serving place and just been put down. So it was a combination of country living as well. But after all, you couldn't escape wood ticks and things of that sort in California in those days.
No, certainly not. Did you ever discuss politics or hear Mrs. Hurst give her views on this?
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, with the people who were down there, there was nearly always distinguished people coming in from Washington. It was really, in many ways, a center of life on the coast where people who were of importance were invited down and entertained. And the Hoovers were there quite often. He was a brilliant young mining engineer there.
Oh, yes.
Now, he must have still been in his middle 30s when I met him first down there, because I was just a freshman. And he was so nice to a boy starting in mining. He was such a wonderful person. He had a great interest in young people even then. And I remember he would talk to me a lot about mining careers and things of that sort. I was always tremendously flattered to anybody. His distinction as a mining man then, I would spend time with a youngster. His boys were just very young then. Were quite young, I think. I've forgotten just how old they were. But I didn't see very much of him after those early years. In fact, I had nothing to do with his Belgian relief work or nothing to do with him as in the years he was president. But after he was out of the White House, I did have quite a number of occasions when I was with him. And he spoke about the early days down there, remembered me as a boy, and was always extremely friendly and sent me copies of his books and things.
Fascinating.
So even the last years up at the Bohemian Grove, I always made a point to go up to his camp, and he'd want me to sit down, talk over old mining experiences and things.
Now, was he a gold and copper man as you?
He went to, he was into pretty nearly everything, but one of his early jobs was in Australia, in Western Australia, and he was in charge of a mine called the Sons of Gwalia, G-W-A-L-I-A, I think, which was a successful mine.
Sons of?
That was copper. Gold. And then he became associated with a group of consulting engineers operating a big operating company in London. And his interest really took him all over the world in that connection. And that's where he was. Well, that led to him being in England at the time of 1914 when the war broke out.
Oh, yes.
But he had played a big part in getting the Americans who were stranded home. That was really his first war activity. Mm-hmm. And then that led into his heading up the Committee for the Relief of Belgium, which functioned until we went into the war. And then he came back, became food administrator for Wilson. And that's the way he left mining.
Right. Now, how did you determine when you were going to go to Cal, to the university?
Well, growing up down at the old Hacienda, P.B. Hirst household, really I heard all my life the university. It was a great ideal, living in Berkeley and living down there. So I had no other thoughts except that I would go to Berkeley. And then I was impressed with the background of the mining there. And in those days, the manager, who was called the superintendent then, the Homestead Mine, T.J. Greer, and his family often came down to visit at the Hacienda Pleasanton. So I became very good friends with them. I did go up to lead the Black Hills in one of my summer vacations. Worked in the mine. I think I worked in the cyanide plant up there one summer. And so that more or less started my interest. So when Mrs. Hastie built the mining building, so I heard a great deal about that. And I knew the Dean, Christie, and, well, they all, mining seemed a very great thing to go into. And mining was quite a glamorous field in those days. That is, it was it's dwindled on, died practically on the vine as a field of, at the university, not only here, but so many different places. But in those days, it was one of the glamour fields. And it seemed rather a natural thing to go in, especially at the old building, at the new building as it was then. So that's the way I started mining. Of course, even in the mining curriculum, as it was in those days, for the first 3 years, it was mostly mathematics, physics, chemistry, and geology, mm-hmm. and engineering. And the mining aspects of it, you really didn't get into until your senior year. But I rather drifted away from the strict interest in the mining side into geology, for I was took some courses under Andy Lawson, who was a great teacher, and George Lauterbach. So I think my interest rather strayed from mining as it was taught then, Christie was dean, and quite an extraordinary old boy. But it seemed to me that the future was not the sort of things he was teaching, but in the geological side. And I was very much enamored of chemistry in those days, very nearly shifted to chemistry, but decided to not do it. So I did graduate in mining, but with a lot of attention to geology. So then, Mrs. Hirsch, after I graduated, just said, well, no, I want you to go on to Harvard, do whatever you want, graduate work. So I said, well, I'd like to go on into geology at Harvard. And Lawson, I remember, recommended going on to Harvard, especially to work with Daly. He thought Daly was a very wonderful person, Reginald Daly, who was a professor at Harvard. And though I took courses with him, we became very good friends, especially when I was back on the faculty. I really didn't have very much. I didn't do my principal work under him, after all, but under Professor Grattan at Harvard. Mm-hmm. But that's more or less the way I drifted into geology. Of course, in those days, you had, well, and still do, there was a lot of field work in geology here in Berkeley. And Lawson taught the class in field geology in the Berkeley Hills there.
Oh, now what would you do? You would go out into the hills?
Yes, every Saturday.
We'd
go out in a group of about, perhaps 15, and mapped the geology of the hills. As we had maps, and Lawson would just turn his loose up there. Then he'd check over what we'd put down, say something sarcastic, and send it out.
Well, I thought when you were describing how the artesian wells operated in the Pleasanton Valley, I think a geologist would explain it that way. It was very clear.
Well, that's,
but you were explaining the various kinds of
materials. Yes, it's the water under pressure. It's held in by the silts above, and it's a very interesting geological story there, for those gravels of all that big drainage that comes down through the Livermore Valley goes out through the Niles Canyon. For that Niles Canyon country has been uplifted on a series of faults, and those gravels are dropped down into a basin. Then there's solid rock down here. So it's a very interesting geological setup, and that was a very important part of the water supply for San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And they still get water from there.
Yeah.
That was why the water temple was built, in the Sonoma Valley.
Of course.
And the Spring Valley Water Company, which is now owned by San Francisco, owns great areas of that land down there still. But most of the water now, a great deal of the water comes in through the tunnels coming in from Hetch Hetchy. Mm-hmm. So I drifted into geology that way.
Yes, I see.
You were talking about Mrs. Hurst's own character. She must have been a very forceful person on the Regents, because I remember looking over some of the old minutes and seeing how Mr. Hurst, President Wheeler would say, well, we must consult Mrs. Hurst about this. Or we must, this would be subject to Mrs. Hurst's approval. So I rather imagine that she was a fairly dominant little lady on the board. But she was gentle, but by no means saccharine. She really was a very strict person. Anybody in her family had to follow a certain code of behavior that, well, it seemed a normal code at the time, but it wouldn't fit in today very well.
Well, her son slipped the leash a bit, of course.
Oh, yes, and perhaps that was
part of it.
Family rebellions took place even in those days.
Yeah.
But in her own house, that was it. There was a pattern. So there were a few other boys down there. Randolph Apperson, who died 4 or 5 years ago, he was her nephew. It's his son, Bill Apperson, now that's involved in this controversy with the Sierra Club and so on about Apperson Ridge.
Oh, that, of course.
And that's the Apperson's, Albert Apperson was Phoebe Hurst's brother. And he lived down at Sonoma. The old house, I think, is still standing there. And he had a ranch down south of the Sonoma Valley. And that's the ranch that now is Apperson Ridge. His grandson, who owns it, of course, is now trying to sell it to Utah Construction.
Yes. Do you have any views about this? Just as a
oh,
issue?
No. I do think that it would be an awful eyesore, right at the edge of the park. Mm-hmm. Though I probably differ from my wife a bit in this. with this great population, you have to have sources of rock. And while I hate to see that country, that particular area, a lovely country, turned into a quarry, we'll have to find it someplace. And it's not as bad as the Kaiser quarries.
No.
Right over here in the Berkeley Hills, which no. torn a lovely valley to pieces.
Yes, this really is one of the complicated problems
yes.
of the time, isn't it?
Yes.
We need it, but we don't want to describe.
There's not a great deal of good rock around here for crushed rock. For
is that necessary for roads? Road building?
Roads and all sorts of construction.
Mm-hmm.
And concrete, things of that sort.
Yeah.
But, so I think I'd be best pleased if the, they didn't put a quarry down there.
Yes. I quite sympathize. Were there other young people in Mrs. Hurst's household, a niece or
yes, there
girl?
Was a young fellow, William W. Murray, who was a cousin of Mrs. William Randolph Hearst, a New York boy, who came out here, and Mrs. Hearst, in her usual way of liking to help young boys, put him through college in Berkeley. And then after he got a job in the estate, and he spent his practically his whole life in the San Francisco office of the Hearst estate after Mrs. Hearst's death. And he's retired now and lives over in Broadway Terrace down here. And then there was the manager of the Hearst estate for years was Edward Clark, who was president of the Homestead Mine, also president of Cerro de Pasco.
Oh, I see.
And his son was Edward Clark Jr., and his daughter Helen Clark, who is dead now, were down there a great deal, and they were very close friends of mine. Edward Clark Jr., Eddie Clark Jr., is living in San Francisco now.
Oh, I see. And there was, in one of the books, there was a reference to a young cousin, I think, of Mrs. Hearst's.
Well, that was Edward Clark, Sr.
And then there was also a young woman. I'll check this for next time. I was just curious.
There were two young women down there, older than I am, next generation up. Oh, I guess they're 10 to 15 years older. Ann Apperson.
This is the one.
Yes.
I was trying to remember.
And Agnes Lane Leonard, she's dead. Mrs. Ann Apperson is now married a doctor, Joseph Marshall Flint, in the San Francisco Medical School. And he eventually became, I think, the head of the Yale Medical School.
Mm-hmm.
And she's still living. And rather an interesting little bit there. There was a lovely girl down there, one of my very dear friends, Harriet Bradford. You have a tape? No, you don't have a tape.
No, you know, I tried to trace that and I didn't
no,
find
it. No, I'll tell you about that later. She was this daughter of a sea captain. He was all known as Captain Bradford, a handsome old boy. And she was down there a great deal as a young girl. She was about my age, and I don't know how it was an old friendship in San Francisco, I think. And Mrs. Hearst sent her to Bryn Mawr, and she did very well. And she became Dean of Women for a while at Stanford.
Is that right?
And then took a law degree at the University of Chicago and ended up in a Boston law firm. And she never married, and we kept up our friendship over the years. She died about a year or so ago, and in her will she left me a portrait of Ann Apperson. I don't quite know what to do with this out in the hall there now. It's rather nice, not a great portrait.
And, yes, what a nice sentimental thing.
Yes. So, she was really a very wonderful person.
Oh, well, this, you know, I'm so astonished at the way these names just pop out of your mind.
Well, it is funny how you recall all these things. Now, there's a little lady up in Chico. I have a mental blank. I know it perfectly well.
Pick her up, certainly.
Who became very much interested in writing and investigating Phoebe Hary's history. And she more or less made a lifetime work.
I think Mr. Cantor of the archives told me about her.
Yes.
I think he knows
her
name.
She is not a person of very much formal education, but she's just devoting her life to investigating Mrs. Hirst, and she's getting in touch with the people in Missouri where Mrs. Hirst came from. They've organized a Phoebe Hirst society, and they have the schoolhouse in which Phoebe Hirst taught as a preserved as a relic in Missouri, and she's been active in trying to accumulate records of this sort. She has a very good one from Harriet Bradford, which Harriet sent me to listen to, and that now is in the hands of this little lady.
Oh, I see. Well, we'll
she's a very nice little person. Now,
may even have her name here in my notes. I'll look before we
you
meet
may.
Next time.
And she also, I think, Eddie Clark made a record for her. Mm.
Is his name spelled with an E?
No, C-L-A-R-K. Mm-hmm. And he married Peggy Nichols, the daughter of the old Episcopalian Bishop Nichols. Mm-hmm. I was best man at their wedding. This was back about 1919, I think.
I see.
So they're divorced now, unfortunately. But this little lady up at Chico has been very active, and not having a lot of the academic credentials, the Bancroft Library hasn't taken her as seriously as she thinks she should be taken.
That's an interesting little sideline.
And she wanted to work down here in records and so on, and I really think they brushed her off.
Did they hurt her feelings?
Yes. So she has it in for the library. And Harriet Bradford sent her all her letters.
So she has the letters?
She has those letters. And I was terribly afraid that she'd get to W.R. Jr.
Yes.
But those letters are definitely in the Bancroft now. Those are the important letters. All the letters of Phoebe Hirst herself. Which were at San Simeon.
Oh, that's where they were.
Now, I think, are into the Bancroft. This little organization in Missouri, the little lady up in Chico, it's no place for the documents that might become some historical interest.
Of course, well, that is really delightful.
But I think the Bancroft Library better cultivate her.
Well, I think you have a very good point. Very good. They'll have to tip off Bancroft, especially if she is in possession of all these wonderful...
Well, she has the Harriet Bradford letters. And this Phoebe Hirst Society in Missouri is, it's a little amateurish group of devoted people, but I think more interested in Phoebe's contribution to the Parent Teachers Association and that sort of thing than the University of California.
That's very interesting. You have to be wary of your friends. Well, this is just delightful, but I see I'm coming to the end of the tape, and I'm sure your time is running out at this point.
Do you want to go on with it some other day?
I see, you know, you were going to have lunch company.
Yes, I've got to go over with John Simpson.